My name is Karen Collins, and I've met some of you before. I work at the National Council of Churches in New York City. I have been there for the last 6 years, where I've been working primarily on child advocacy issues, child care, child health, and I'm now focusing on health issues. But prior to that, I did a degree in early childhood education at Bank Street College of Education, which is familiar to some people who are involved in early childhood, and directed a nursery school for 7 years. And my husband and I are now on the board of our own children's daycare center, so I come to it with that kind of a background. And also because I just feel that, as this week of sessions reflects, that in working with young children, whatever our capacity with young children is, that we really need to take very seriously those pieces of our society and those ethical values which in some way inhibit the full development of our children and therefore undermine ourselves as a nation and a workforce. The issue of class is one that we all know a lot about because it's so much a piece of who we are, but it's not one that we necessarily do a lot of thinking about, and it's not one that people necessarily talk about a lot. So what I hope that we can do today is really think with each other and not only learn from some of the things that I can bring to it, but learn from each other about it, because class issues are very complex, and I think that it's only when we begin to delve a little more deeply that we begin to appreciate that and begin to see the subtleties of the things we need to be aware of when we're working with young children. Because class issues are so complex, I think that all children can be hurt, no matter what their class background is, that all children can be hurt in one way or another from their class background. At the same time, all children reap benefits from their class background in one way or another. But I think that the children that I always want to hold up as children that I want to be particularly concerned about are those children who are poor or working class or lower class, because having money, being able to buy things, material wealth in this culture is so important, that children who don't have financial means are often the children who feel the difference the most. And so I want to start off with just one story from Welcome the Child, which is a publication from the Children's Defense Fund designed for congregational use on child advocacy issues. This is a 10-year-old story. I was asked to tell you what it's like to live in a single-parent home with no money. Sometimes it's sad because I feel different from other kids. For instance, when other kids get to go to fun places and I can't because I don't have enough money and they do. Most of my friends get an allowance, but I don't because my mom doesn't have enough money to pay me. They get to get the things that they want and need, and I don't. The other day in school, we had this balloon contest, and it only cost $1, and out of 3 years, I haven't been able to get one any of those years. Me and my brother are a little hard on shoes. This summer, the only shoes we had were thongs, and when church time came, the only shoes we had to wear were one pair of church shoes. The one that got them first got to wear them. The one that didn't had to wear a pair of my mom's tennis shoes or my sister's. I have a big brother. He's not my real big brother. He is with the Big Brothers and Big Sisters Association. Once I tried to tell my big brother about welfare. It was so embarrassing, I was about to cry. I don't like Joe just because he takes me to a fun place each week. I like Joe because he makes me feel special. Sometimes I pray that I won't be poor no more, and sometimes I sit up at night and cry. But it didn't change anything. Crying just doesn't help the hurt and the pain. It doesn't change anything. One day I asked my mom why the kids always tease me. And she said, because they don't understand, because I do understand about being on welfare and being poor, and it can hurt. That's from a 10-year-old. Young children begin to learn about power and about relationships from a very young age. And those of us who have raised young children know that, you know, when we're dealing with very young children, they already have a clear sense of power vis-a-vis their mother and father. And having a 1.5-year-old and a 3.5-year-old, I'm learning a lot about manipulation and power relationships with young children. And they learn about power and relationships at different stages. We've talked about in some of the other sessions how at the age of 2, children are learning about color and gender, how you name those things. So they're beginning to think about, I'm a girl or I'm a boy, she's black and her skin is different from mine, her hair is real curly, mine's straight, she has hazel eyes and I have brown eyes, and we look a little bit different. Children are learning all those things by the time they're 2, turning 3, and by the time they're 3, they're figuring out how they fit into that whole constellation and how they are different or the same as other people, and that which of those things are constant in their lives. Will I always have curly hair? Will I always be black? Will I always be a girl? Will I always be a boy? When I grow up, will I be a daddy or will I be a grandmother? We have to figure out all those things. By the time children are 4 and 5, they've already adapted and assumed some... Come on in, Ruby. we've made
to
one...
Speak in late, look what happens.
Well, can't do that. let me just continue with this, and then I'll ask you to introduce yourself, okay? I mean, most people know you, but we'll do it anyway. By the time children are 4 and 5, they've really adopted and are trying on for size a lot of the social norms, a lot of the ways of behaving that are around them in their society. So by the time a child is 4 and 5, we hear sexist comments, racist comments, some other kinds of comments that we may or may not be comfortable with, probably are not comfortable in this community. And those attitudes, assumptions, stereotypes are not completely set in stone yet, but they are a part of those children's play. Now, when we're talking about class, I think it's a little bit different, that by the time children are 3, 4, and 5, they are learning a lot about power relationships. And I think when we're talking about class, we are talking about power, because certainly with money and with financial well-being comes access to political power, access to material wealth, access to employment, access to good education, and so many other things which are roots to power. But children, my experience is that young children, very young children, don't yet perceive the kind of class differences in quite the same way that they are some of the other differences, and that comes at the end of the preschool years and the beginning of the elementary years. And those of you who are elementary teachers have probably seen a lot of it when children are 5, 6, 7 and older, where they really begin to compare themselves to their peers, and becoming part of a group and social acceptance are very, very important. But then they become more and more aware of what those differences are in class background. And so that I think, you know, we need to be aware of all of that, and aware of the fact that damaging things can happen to children, but at the same time, this is a time of tremendous opportunity, because this is when children are learning. This is when they're putting the building blocks together, and when they're figuring out who they are in their world and how the world works. So it's really a time of, I think, for us both tremendous opportunity, but also as people who understand children, who understand people who work and are committed to communities, it's also a time of real responsibility. And I think as people of faith, it's also a time of real responsibility vis-a-vis those children. We were talking earlier that those of us who are educators, there's a concept, there's different concepts of education. And some of us think of education as something which happens in a classroom, or a workshop, or a training session, or a Sunday school classroom, or perhaps in worship on Sunday morning. But that education is really much broader than that. That education happens throughout our society. We are always learning all the time. And those of us who are educators need to take that very seriously. That our job doesn't stop when we walk out of the classroom. or out of the school building, or when we leave our children, or when we leave church. Our job is going on all the time, because as educators, recognizing that education happens everywhere, we're always a part of that. And as people with skills in working with people, working with children, and understanding pedagogy and education, our responsibility really never stops. I mean, that's not to add a burden, but I think it is to help us see our role in a new perspective and perhaps to see ourselves in a slightly more powerful way, that we really are people who are privileged to be in a position to really have an influence in many, many aspects of our lives. And certainly on issues related to class, that's one piece of it. Does anybody have comments about any of those thoughts?
Yeah, I would just take some issue with you on the whole matter of defining class strictly in terms of money,
mm-hmm.
or defining economically, because you find class distinctions also among the poor,
mm-hmm.
Poor economically, in that, for example, in most churches, there's a class structure. Those people who are the leaders in the church, or the people who are perceived as the religious pillars, who may or may not be economically well off, in fact, might be rather poor. You also find it also among people, for example, who are involved in education or so on,
mm-hmm.
who may be a very moderate income, but have an intellectual superiority that they communicate to their children, so on like this. And then you see people who have money who we would say are absolutely, low rent or low class. I mean, they just are really, they don't have, they may have money, but they are, they don't have any manners, let's say. They don't have any, so I don't think you can define class. It's simplistic to define class strictly in terms of
economic. I think your point is well taken, that the class issues are very complicated, and there's certainly, I think you're right, that there certainly are, we have a lot of choices in our lives. Many of us have choices in our lives. And I want to explore the complexity of class by talking among ourselves a little bit. But I think at the same time, it is important to understand how fundamental finances are.
I understand.
Yeah,
because on our system, our capitalism.
And also, what comes to mind is, I was reading a book recently, which had one particular concept had a real impact on me. It's a book called Alive and Well? ? It's a book about child health in this country. And what the author was doing was, she was talking about the patterns by which parents deal with their children vis-a-vis health issues. And recognizing that in different cultures, there are very different patterns for dealing with health. And when you look at poor communities, financially poor communities, as opposed to financially affluent communities, there are very different patterns. You may not go to the doctor as much if you're poor. You may not be up to date on your immunizations or in your inoculations. You may not have the same, you may not take as good care of yourself. You may do a variety of things. And what she was saying is that there are habits in some communities, and usually less affluent communities, which are detrimental to health. And then she said, but if we look at all these people again and rule out the variable of financial difference, the patterns of health become exactly the same. And I think that underscored for me just how fundamental having money is. That it really does make an enormous difference, not only in what we buy, but how we live our lives. And that's not to undermine your point at all, but just to reiterate perhaps how complicated issues of class are, but also how important money is.
I think what you're talking about is a little different definition of class, I think, because you're talking about social, economic classes, but that the kids may not even be aware they're in, but you're talking about the ones they are aware they're in, and the ones they set up between, the people set up between themselves, like, they're better than I am type of thing, mm-hmm. and they're really aware of it, and, like, within a classroom, you see kids who are, like, where I teach, there's only one black child in a school of 500 kids, but that kid is really quite wealthy, but he is not one of the more popular kids, and he's, I don't know, it's money doesn't matter within a group of kids who are all rich. If there's other things matter, and the classes are redefined within the rich class, I guess, and that's what you're talking about, the kids that are rude and the kids that are snobby or whatever, they're a different class and people don't like them, and so they're kind of like at the bottom of the pecking order within that group.
Let's explore this a little bit more, and not so much just, oh, Ruby, introduce yourself to people who may not know who you are.
Oh, I'm Ruby Harris, and I'm from Tacoma, and I work at a Christian school.
You want to say any more about what that means?
Well, it's predominantly black. It was started 6 years ago. We've completed our sixth year, and it's headed quite a bit by single female households and families, the families are. And a lot of the people send their children for discipline as well as Christian education.
Mm-hmm.
It was started because a lot of our children's needs were not being met in a public setting. And while I'm talking, I think class basically is money. Money is the stepping stone, but then after that there are finer definitions, but the basic foundation is money. Because even in a poor community, we were all poor, but a person who had two pairs of place shoes was considered something else. Even though in our neighborhood, it was like the blight of Yakima and everybody down there was nothing, but even within it, the distinctions were based mostly on money. And I think that probably in any society, that's the way it is. You know, you can have a class of poor, but you've got upper poor and lower poor and middle poor, and you get to the middle class, you've got the same distinctions, and you've got the same distinctions in the rich. But basically, the dividing line is money. And then within those sections, there becomes finer definitions, but basically money is it.
You know, family, our neighborhood is in Chicago, the neighborhoods changed so quickly, just within a couple blocks, and our church sponsored a day camp a while back, and we got to know a family, 13 people living in one apartment, 11 kids or 12 kids, I guess. That was very educational because my younger sister would stay overnight with them, and you know, two people per bed, and that was very different even from our house 3 blocks away, where we each had our own bedroom and carpeting and air conditioning and all the food in the world. So that was good for us to experience that, and also good for the kids who came into our house. And the one girl especially came with us on family vacations occasionally and would stay overnight and saw our standard of living. Turns out she's the first in her family to graduate from high school, first one to get married without having children first.
Mm-hmm.
And she's in, you know, done very well and is planning on going to college. So I think for both families it was a good exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And right in the same practice, same neighborhood.
We do a thing in our school, it's a multicultural week, and we have different groups come in and do performances. Like, we had a group come in and do the dance from the African culture, and then each class has to provide a booth and cook food and talk about the customs, and they learn it over like 8 or 9 weeks, and then the whole week we open our gym up and have the booths up and invite the community, and the kids are there to tell people as they come by about it and about that country that they picked. And it's really neat because the kids are cooking the food that other cultures are cooking, and they're learning all their customs.
So outside of your own neighborhood, so you would actually say internationally or other
mm-hmm.
countries?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And for many of them, it's their call. We have a lot of Japanese, we have a lot of Mexican who in our school. So it's learning about their peers that they're with each day.
Uh-huh. I think that one of the things that we need to be careful, I mean, I think this is a very important point that you're raising. I think also that it's a tricky point because there's two ways of thinking about exposing children to different, ever different racial ethnic backgrounds, different class backgrounds, differences in the way different people are raised and live. And there's the multicultural approach, which is actually not very clearly defined because people use it in different ways, and then there's the anti-bias approach. But the concept that I think is important is that we do it in a way which fully appreciates the people who are different from us, which does not become a kind of tourist approach, which doesn't just become approach which always only looks at the holidays or only looks at something which is exotic or different or stereotypic, but an approach which really allows us to get to know the other person on a day-to-day basis, which allows us within an other country, for example, if we were studying Japan, which would really allow us to appreciate the differences within Japan, that all Japanese are not a particular way, that within the Japanese culture there's all these other intricacies and cultures, so that we really learn on a very in a very meaningful way and not as kind of superficial, stereotypic way. And I think that a lot of that same thing can be thought about in terms of within the United States, that we are many, many, many cultures within the United States, and that we need to appreciate other cultures within our own country in the same kind of, with the same kind of sensitivity. I think Ruby and Moses brought it up in one of your sessions earlier. You know, I don't speak for all black folks, is what you said. Because there are so many cultures and so many different belief systems, and everybody's different, and every individual is an individual. There's a lot of different sets of experiences, albeit a black experience and a European American experience and an Irish experience or a Jewish experience or whatever your own experience happens to be. So that we need to really learn about other experiences, but to do it in a way which is not patronizing, which is not trivializing, which really appreciates the complexity of each different culture.
Mm-hmm. One thing that came to mind when you were talking earlier, I was thinking with this group I teach, they're rich, and so I was thinking a good way of approaching it isn't doing it with children, it's doing it with the parents. Mm-hmm. And through the PTSA, discuss class, what class they're in, and if there are any different classes within school, discuss the problems, and like you said, they're no matter what class you're in, there's bad and then there's good, and just to have that brought up, and like I said, it is hard to discuss your class.
I was along that line, talking about the good and bad in each. I wanted to do something that we're not going to have time to do because I really want to focus on what can we do vis-a-vis children. But I wanted to do something else in between talking about our own class backgrounds and talking about what we can do with our children, which would have been to create a grid like this, where we would have talked about poor families, middle income, or poor class, middle income, middle class, what do we call it, class? Poor class, middle class, and affluent or wealthy. And then to run the grid the other way, pro and con, or benefits and deficit, detriment.
Detriment.
But to do that, to try and get at what it is, you know, what it, as a poor child growing up, what are some of the beneficial parts of your culture? I mean, what do you learn? What do poor parents work very hard to give their children, which is a benefit that they carry with them? And what other things is a deficit as a consequence of your class? And the same thing with the affluent. I mean, being affluent is not all good. I mean, there are real detriments that go along with it. For example, it's often hard for, I understand, for an affluent person to appreciate that they are good for just who they are. Not for what they have or what they can do or what they've achieved, but for who they are. That's much tougher for an affluent person to be able to really own that, to really believe that in their heart of hearts. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to do that, but I think it's a useful thing to do in a group when we're working on class issues. But let's focus on this. We've got about 5 more minutes. What other kinds of things can we do with children and with parents and with people that children interact with to help them vis-a-vis class issues? What is our goal vis-a-vis children anyway?
That they feel good about themselves.
Okay.
And not be hurt by offhand statements or just by the fact that they aren't like someone else or don't have as much.
For children to feel good about themselves.
I think to be able to function in the society that we live in.
Right.
I think to inculcate a more egalitarian view of society, or of their peers, I guess you'd say. Well, in other words, I'm not, just because I have money or I don't have money, I'm not any different than you are. I'm
but that's
better
not true.
Anybody.
We well, don't want to teach them that till it's really true.
Well, I think it is true.
You think that's true?
I think it is true.
I think it is true
because the fact that I don't have money doesn't mean that I'm not just as good as a person who does.
Sure.
Better off in this society is a different issue than a better person.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't.
You're not a better person because you got more money.
Right.
But
there's a lot of people that got a lot of money that I wouldn't want to associate with.
Exactly.
I mean, because one has wealth does not mean that one has a happy life.
I was just thinking, the kids I work with, when they come in, I do a lot of groups and classroom stuff, and I rarely hear them say, well, how much money do you make? Or do you do Kmart or anything like that? But what I do hear is, you act like a dope, or, you know, you're always beating up on people. And it's more behavior sorts of things that they put each other down for rather than money, rather than talking class and that. And some of that may be a result of that, the children in some homes, there isn't a lot of money, so they struggle with the basic needs, which creates more behavior problems. But the children themselves, I don't see that as much as an issue for them as it might be for me as an adult.
So what can you do when that kind of stuff is going on? When children are putting each other down, I mean, that's one of the places where we can step in as people who appreciate the...
And straighten the child out and tell him that he's no different than you because he's got money. It doesn't make any difference. It really doesn't make a bit of difference. You're still a human being, and should treat that child the same as you've been treated. Don't ever treat this, your friend, any differently than you like to be treated. That doesn't make any difference.
I do work with them in terms of anger management and self-esteem and don't even address the money stuff and all that, but caring about themselves. A lot of it starts, I think, about just caring about themselves, and then they're more likely to treat others better with that.
I have a daughter, for example, who's a gifted child, and she's a grown woman now, a baby of her own, but I remember very clearly she was in first grade. And she was talking to me, she says, Daddy, there's this girl in class, she can't even read the word look, L-O-O-K, look. And she was going on and on and on about how stupid she was. And couldn't understand. And I says, well, it turned out my daughter was not very well coordinated, and she came to skipping the rope once. She had a tremendous amount of frustration. So I used that as an example. I said, you know how some children can skip rope, and you spent two whole days practicing skipping rope in the backyard, and you never did quite get it? I said, so some children can skip rope real good, and some children can't read the word look.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, and she understood at that level, mm-hmm, the differences in that there are gifts, and I remember very clearly that conversation and recognizing how important it was at that moment. Because that's what it was about, because she was always smarter than all the other kids.
I think it's important that part of our goals or what we can do is is point these distinctions out, whether they're economic or behavioral or whatever, but also say that they're not locked into them, that you aren't a middle class and here are your lines, and you aren't rich and here are your lines, but you actually are an individual that you may have most of the characteristics of a certain class or distinction, however you do that, but that everybody is different. You are different, and every person you're going to come across is not just a middle-class person or whatever their background is.
And you can't classify yourself because in my lifetime, I've gone from the lowest poor that a person could be in the depression years when I was a small child, up to upper middle class, and my sister has got a family that is affluent. And this doesn't mean, if we thought in our mind and our parents raised us to think that you're poor and don't ever forget it, then we would still be poor. Mm-hmm. You can't, you vary, you go from one through your whole life, you go from one class to another, mm-hmm. easily. And we were always raised to think money, you're no different than anybody else. You're just as good, and we raised our children the same way. You're just as good as that person that's rich. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really make any difference, and we just have always lived that way.
And I think the other thing that's important is to let kids and parents know they have choices. Because I know some of the low-income moms I work with is like, I don't have a way out of this. And as long as they don't see that there's, or even think there's a way out, there isn't a way out.
That's right. They get locked into this class thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think another thing that we
some are trapped. Some really are trapped.
My job is to get them out of it, so I don't think they are. But
you made your name and address. I'm going to refer some people to you. If you really, I mean, if you're serious,
mm-hmm.
because there are people, like you said, it's a circle. If you're on welfare and you make $10, they take $10 away, so you're in the exact same place, except you're working twice as hard. And that's exactly why people say, well, why should I work at all? Mm-hmm. You know, if they would say, okay, we're going to let you be on welfare, you can work 1 year, and we won't deduct your welfare, but at the end of that year, we're kicking you off. And people say, okay, I got a year, I can do it. Mm-hmm. But to make $40 and have self-esteem, and then your check be deducted by $40,
mm-hmm.
and yet you've incurred more expenses by trying to work, mm-hmm. babysitting, and suddenly you got to have a halfway decent pair of shoes, mm-hmm. whereas when you're just sitting at home, so what if you're barefoot? But if you're trying to work, you want to have a lunch, you kind of got to get your hair done. And so it's added expenses to go out and try to make it, and then to have it deducted from the other end and be the exact same spot. You'd have to have a real strong mind to
mm-hmm.
leap above that.
And some of that's how to work the system, too.
Mm-hmm. Which is, gets back to being able to function in society, having some of those skills
mm-hmm.
to work the system.
It is. And then to be able to work there, or to be trained to work the system, is almost being taught to be dishonest, which on the other hand, right. what you're saying, become an honest, productive citizen, but this is how you get around it. Mm-hmm. Well, then the person's thinking, okay, this will get me on top, but they haven't forgotten that you're the one who taught me how to cheat. And so then when I come up and say, okay, now you want to be honest? Yeah, but yesterday you said it would be okay if I took a pencil because I didn't have one. Mm-hmm. You know, and now I'm saying today, don't take his sandwich, but you said I could take his pizza. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have to be real careful what kind of values we're projecting in helping people get ahead because they remember, uh-huh. even though it's to their advantage.
So we have to, so we have to watch what we do, too, watch our own.
We have to live what we preach, I guess is what you call it.
I think for some families, you know, you're so overwhelmed sometimes, it's just, I give up, you know. But if you get an advocate there who does this all the time and works through, and I don't mean to work the system in a bad way, but there are ways to get through some of this stuff, and it is a lot of hard work. And to have someone join your team that can help you with that rather than hinder you with that. That I've seen happen, and it's been real positive.
Oh, it does happen.
And it's true that a lot of us who are middle class and affluent do know how to work the system mm-hmm. in the best sense of the word. I mean, we do know how to get mm-hmm. how to get around, and if we need information, we know how to get it.
Well, we maintain, but in that we are able to maintain our independence and our integrity. And what happens with poor women, particularly, you're talking about, is that it's very difficult to maintain your integrity
mm-hmm.
and work the system.
Mm-hmm.
You have to withhold information. You have to
mm-hmm.
Slide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you really have to do something. I sometimes have more respect for some of these people, some of the women who drop out, and maybe drop the whole welfare system and say to hell with it, and turn tricks because of the fact that they can make more money and have more control over their lives.
I would suggest that two other things that we need to put in, that I would like to see put in under goals, is learning to think critically and having a vision for themselves of their own futures.